Alright, welcome to class today. I hope you all had yourselves an enjoyable weekend. Before we begin, are there any comments, questions, concerns, other things for me?
Yeah, so there'll be a rubric with multiple items trying to evaluate different parts of the proof skill we were hoping you would demonstrate. So depending exactly where you messed up, that may be a different amount of points. That rubric hasn't been finalized, so I can't tell you exactly where the points are going. But the goal is to give points for the skills you demonstrate. You're welcome. Other question? All right. Today, and you notice for the next little while, we have induction on 4 days here. Induction is a proof technique we'll talk about. We have a brief introduction to it early in today's lecture. We'll probably get to more of it by the end of today's lecture. We'll see. We're also going to talk about proof by cases today, which you notice are not on the other days. Proof by cases I'm expecting will be fairly quick to discuss. There's really only one sort of nuance to it, and then a little trick, so we'll sort of show a little bit about how that works. And we actually have, under here, we have, for example, a proof of De Morgan's Law by cases, and also a guide to different proof techniques that we'll talk about. So we may look at some of that, although in general I'm going to try to leave that for you if you want additional information as well. And we'll get into induction more, maybe probably at the end of the class day, if not definitely on Wednesday, as we'll go into that a little bit for the next week or so. So let me talk about different proof techniques and sort of why we use them, what they're for. So we've really talked about two broad categories of proof techniques so far. We've talked about direct proof. And this is what we used first, so you may not even thought about it as being a proof strategy, but like the this is equivalent to that is equivalent to that is equivalent to that is direct proof. We're just going directly from one thing to another until we end up having proven what we want. And we've done proof by contradiction. We've done, just briefly, we've talked about instantiation. And we'll actually talk a little bit more about that probably on Friday as a proof technique as well. Often instantiation sort of gets lumped in with direct proof, so we'll say a little bit more about that. We're going to add two more proof strategies, but let me give a little bit of a context about this. First, contradiction is primarily how we prove things are impossible. It's its main use. It's mainly for impossibility proofs. Not all impossibility proofs use contradiction, and not all proof by contradictions are proof of impossibility, and we showed you a variety to get you a sense of this. But in computing, usually if you see a proof by contradiction, it's to prove that something can't be done. So if, for example, I want to prove that some problem cannot be solved by computers, which will be a major topic in theory of computation, we'll do that by proof by contradiction. We'll assume we had a solution to it, and then show it contradicts something. I'm going to prove something can't be done quickly. We'll generally show that assume there was a fast one and show it contradicts something and so forth. So that's usually what we use contradiction for. Direct proof is sort of the baseline, the glue that holds pieces together. And you can think of direct proof in many ways as being like the sequential statements in a programming language, right? When I'm writing some program and I say x equals y plus z, and then on the next line I say something equals some function of x, right, this is the idea I'm going from one line to the next. And that same kind of idea is being used in our direct proofs. We're doing one thing, then another, and then another. And the two new proof strategies we're going to talk about this week are other constructs in programming. Okay? So we have this idea of direct proof. We also sort of have the idea of functions with our lemmas. Right? We prove something and refer to that proof, that sort of thing. We weren't going to talk a lot about that in this class. But what we are going to talk about is what is the equivalence of an if-else, and what is the equivalence of a for loop or other looping structure? If we can get something that acts like if-else and something that acts like for, then we're going to have proof techniques we can use to analyze all different kinds of programs. In particular, when I want to prove some program works, if I use direct proof for the places it's in statement after statement, and whatever it is for if the if-else portion of proof for that part, and the looping part for loop parts, then I can get up with a proof that looks like my code to use to prove something about my code, whatever it is I want to prove about my code. And so a lot of proofs in computing are going to use the two structures that we're going to talk about today, because a lot of code uses these structures, a lot of algorithms use these structures. So let's start with the if-else. We call this cases. Okay, so the two most common formal name for it is we say we proceed with a case analysis, or by cases. Okay, but we talk about cases for our if-else. There's going to be some special rules for these that we're going to talk about later, and let me just briefly so we know where we're going. For is going to be induction, and our loops are going to be induction. We're not going to say a lot more about induction right now besides sort of getting you ready for the idea it's going to come. And it's actually going to use a little bit of cases, because we think about what a loop actually does is it says, if something is true, do some work, and then come back again. And so we're going to have an if-like construct inside our induction, just like we have an if-like construct inside our for. We're going to have a case-like construct inside induction to eventually stop the loop, to stop the induction. Just like we check a condition repeatedly to stop our loops. We're going to first really dive into this idea of case analysis. Okay, let me give you the formal rule for case analysis. If I know A or B, and I know that A proves C, and I know that B proves C, then I can derive C. Three things I have to know in order to get to my conclusion. A, if I know that A or B is true, and I know that if A was true, it proves C, I know that B is true, it proves C, then I can prove C. I may not know which of A or B is true, but whichever one is true, you could pick the appropriate smaller proof to get to your final result. Okay, this is the basic idea of proof by cases. And technically, we've actually already seen proof by cases. Our truth tables are a special case of proof by cases. They're so special that we'll usually call them truth tables, not proof by cases. But let's just sort of take a simple example. Let's suppose I want to prove that not P is equivalent to P. Now, we just said this is a proof rule, and we can show you a truth table to handle it. But let's try writing this out as a proof by cases. There is one assumption I'm always allowed to make, A or not A. This is, in fact, the assumption made by an if-else. So if I think about if A and then else, what is the condition that applies to the else? The condition that applies to the else is not A. So an if-else statement is splitting into something is true or that same thing is false. Okay? And so this is something we're always allowed to do. And so what we're going to do here is we're going to consider the case where P is true, and we're going to consider the case where P is false. These are going to be our two cases. Either P is true or not P is true. Either P is true or P is false. And then, of course, what can I do here? Now I could just say that P, not P, is equivalent to not true, is equivalent to not false, is equivalent to true. And down here, I could say not P is equivalent to, I guess I need to go that last step, is equivalent to P. Here I say not P is equivalent to not false, is equivalent to not true, is equivalent to false, is equivalent to P. And this is what our truth table is doing. We do these in columns instead of big lines, right? But this is the idea, is we're considering all of the possible cases, all of the values some variable could have. And we're checking that all of them show something, that they all show some equivalence, right? Now, to put this together into a proof, we need to have our cases and the proofs inside of them, however we decide to write those proofs. I did here in these sort of one line long chain of equivalences. You can do however you want. We'll see some more examples as we go forward. But we also, with all proof strategies other than direct proof, we have to have some introduction to tell people what we're doing and some conclusion to tie back to the end result. The introduction is to state the true disjunction. Okay, this is a disjunction. Remember that the or is called a disjunction. Anything with an or is a disjunction. We have to state a true disjunction, and if it's not obviously true, then we're going to have to prove that it's true. For something is true or not, that's obviously true. But if we need to do some extra work to show it, we'd have to do that before. So we would say, we can say, the typical way of doing this is say, either P is true, or it, right? I tell you the disjunction has to be true. There's different, I can use my own wording to do this. This is the most common one I have seen. Either case one or case two. And if I needed some rationale, I would have to put that rationale here as well. I then proceed with the cases. I show that in each of the cases, right, the either or, I check each of the cases. Instantly, there don't have to be just two, right? B could be a compound term with other terms, but we're going to start with just two, right? So I show each of the cases is true. Each of the cases, I need to end up with the same statement, right? And the full statement I have here is not P is equivalent through a lot of other things to P. And so then I would say, because not P is equivalent to P in both cases. That's the text. There's variations on it, but this is the kind of thing I have to say. I have to tell you what it is that all of the cases showed. Because in general, a proof shows a lot of things. So I have to point out, right, I, for example, also proved that not P in this case was true. And not P in this case was false. That isn't what I'm trying to show you. I'm trying to show you not P is equivalent to P. So I need to state what it is that I showed in every case. And if I showed it in every case, and one of the cases has to be true, then the whole theorem has to be true. This is the structure of a proof by contradiction. Questions about this example before we look at some. Why? Because I'm just using this statement to substitute in. Yeah, these are equivalent statements. That's what equivalent means. They're all saying the same thing. I'm trying to prove this thing we've been using as an axiom. As an unproved truth. So I'm trying to prove it without using itself. So I'm just using the definition of not applied to true and false literally. In other words, I am saying, okay, P is true or it is false. So then what is my not P? Well, then, all right, and that's literally what I'm doing here is I'm just saying, well, in this case, this would be not true, which is the same thing as not false, right? So this would be false, which would be the same thing as true. And this one would be the same thing. All right, I would do the other way around, right? But either way, I end up being equivalent to what I started with. It's just a different way of presenting this. Truth tables will only work for Boolean operators, right? I have to be able to enumerate all the cases. For other things, we'll write it out. Other question? All right. Our textbook has a description. Let's just make sure we also, wrong one. Let's make sure we also agree with that description and understand what it is. Okay. They have this weird statement about clubs and friends and strangers as their initial theorem. Okay. But it gives the same general idea. Right? So what are they saying in their first example in the MCS textbook? They have this strange theorem about a collection of six people, includes either a club of three people or a group of three strangers, where they've defined club and stranger earlier. A club is a group of people that have met, a stranger is a group of people that haven't met. Okay, and so they're saying either three have met or three have not met. Okay, and so they have these two different cases. Okay, suppose at least three people did meet one of the people. Then they have subcases. They're trying to make this complicated. You're allowed to use proof strategies inside each other. Right? So they're using a case inside a case. But they'll go through all of their cases in this strange example, and then they say this implies the theorem also holds in case two, and therefore holds in all cases. Right? So you have it holds in case one, it holds in case two, therefore holds in all cases, ta-da. Right, this is the structure. They number their cases instead of labeling them. That's commonly done. You can do it either way. It depends on how you want to address it. But you have the same basic structure for their proof by cases. We also have a conversation about proof by cases in the For All X text. That's about disjunction. Have I linked to the wrong thing? Okay, I've linked to the wrong thing. We'll come back to that. Let's go back to this example we have done. So I just did a very simple rule. Let's look at a slightly more complicated rule, the Morgan's Law. Okay? So De Morgan's Law in a truth table looks like this. And we've done truth tables before. What does it look like as a proof by cases? So I want to prove De Morgan's Law in particular that not P and Q is not P or not Q. Okay? So I decide to just call one of these things that and one of these things this. And I say either P is true or false. I'm just picking one of the values and saying it's either true or false. It has to either be true or false. Everything, every proposition is either true or false. So I have the case where it's true. And then I just substitute that in and use my rules at a very low level here, right? But I walk through all of the steps and end up showing the theorem holds in this case, right? I show what this N was equivalent to. I show what O was equivalent to. Both become not Q. And in the other case, I do it again, and I show they both become just true. And so in one case, they're both keep not Q. In the other case, they're both true. Either way, they're both the same, so the theorem holds in all cases. And this is the whole structure of a proof by cases. You just split the world arbitrarily to try to make it simpler for you, and you can keep going. Right? We could then meet another case that says Q is true or false inside of each of these to show all of the possible cases and finish the truth table. But sometimes one step will be enough to make our life a little easier. Questions about this proof? Oh, I put it way up here. Yeah, De Morgan's Law. It's up at the top. Sorry. Probably should have put it down below. Other questions? All right. We're not going to say a lot more about proof by cases. And the reason we're not going to say a lot more about proof by cases is because the situations where it arises, we find these students who have seen it before tend to understand that it applies. So we don't feel it's usually necessary to spend a lot of time going through how it works. Just remember that the key thing, the thing that students get wrong the most often, is to fail to state this first point. You have to start with a disjunction that is true. Okay, so, for example, here is something that is not okay. Suppose I were to say either P or Q, case P, case Q, and then say because both, because held in all, holds. This is generally the right structure. If I state this without having reason to believe it, I'm in a bit of a problem. I need to actually have reason to believe my either or is true. So let's consider a false theorem here to make this work. Let's suppose I want to prove that P and Q... Oh, let's do this one. I want to show that P or Q is equivalent to true. This is my false theorem that I'm trying to, and I say either P or Q. Right? If P is true, then this becomes true or Q, which is equivalent to true. If Q is true, this becomes P or true, which is equivalent to true. Ta-da! I have proven that P or Q is true, but I haven't. And the thing I have failed to do is that this might be false. I can't just pick anything I want. I have to pick something that is always true. The most common way of doing this, not the only way, but the most common way of doing this is to state a disjunctive tautology. A tautology is any logical statement that is true by structure rather than by the value of its variables. Okay? So if something is equivalent to true, it is a tautology. If it's only true because of the value of the variables, some external information is not included by math, we don't call it a tautology, even though it could still be true. But most of the time, we want a disjunctive tautology to introduce our proof by cases. If it's a disjunctive tautology, we can simply state it and move on. Note, they don't have to be mutually exclusive cases. Right? So P and not P is a clear disjunctive tautology. But I can also make ones that overlap in some way if I want, as long as it's guaranteed that the thing I state here is equivalent to true, then my case analysis will work. If there's a case that it might be missing, right? And here, the missing case is that P and Q are both false. And that missing case it won't hold in, which breaks the whole proof. So we need to make sure that you start with disjunctive tautology, a true disjunction, in order to make proof by cases work. Okay. So, that's our proof by cases. Where you would put an if in your code, you put cases in your proof. Now we're going to start talking about induction. And to start, I'm going to start with an actual code example. Let's imagine I have this code, x equals 0, for I from 1 to n, x is incremented by 1. I realize that each language says from I from 1 to n in a different way. I'm assuming you know how to write it in the language you're used to writing. And then I'm going to return x. And let's call this, how about we call this f of k? Here is my little piece of code. Just take a moment and convince yourself what this function returns. Maybe try it out for a few small n and see what it gives you, and then come up with a general formula. What does f of n return? It is just n. This is a complicated way of doing nothing. Okay, and you're welcome to see, right, if n is 1, then I add just 1 to 0. If n is 2, I add 1, and then 1 again, I add 2 1s to 0. If n is 7, I add 7 1s to 0. I just always end up... We're going to figure out how to prove this. Okay, and we're going to start a way that we would also start when we first teach you loops. I don't know if you remember how you were first taught loop, but usually loops are first taught by unrolling the loop. Okay, so here is how I'm going to prove this. I'm going to say f of 1. I'm just going to make a case for f of 1. F of 1 runs the loop once, returning 0 plus 1 equals 1. I've got another case. F of 2 runs the loop twice, causing me to get 0 plus 1 plus 1 equals 2. Case f of 3 runs the loop 3 times, returning 0 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. Ah! I can't even write that. All right, 0 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 3. Ah! For any given n you pick, I can make this proof. But to try to prove it for all n, this way would require an infinite number of cases. And I don't want to write an infinite number of cases, I'm lazy. So I want to be able to write down a template to apply. Okay? And so for that template to apply is going to look like two cases. I'm going to have what we're going to call the base case, the simplest case that I can think of. So I'm going to proceed by case analysis, which means I first need to state a disjunctive tautology. I'm going to say either x equals 1 or x is greater than 1. Because that's how I worded this, right? So either n is equal to 1 or n is greater than equal to 1. I know that because that was what my theorem stated. And so then I can make cases. N equals 1. And I have my case n is greater than 1. For the case n equals 1, we just did that case, right? I could say f of 1 runs the loop once, returning 0 plus 1. And now I'm going to deal with all other cases all at once. How can I turn each of these things into something I can generalize? Well, this one, I kept writing out all of these things in long form, which is annoying because I'd have to write a different thing every time. Let's consider f of n runs the loop once more than f of n minus 1. Therefore, it returning f of n minus 1. This is going to be my general template. Right? I want to replace the things that have similar structure with variables, with general symbols. This structure works for everything except f of 1. Actually, technically work for f of 1 because this theorem also holds for f of 0, but it wouldn't work for f of 0 because it doesn't hold for f of n minus negative 1. Anyway, we're going to say this is our general form. Now, knowing this, we're just going to say here, we're going to assume I have this thing that I'm just said that it runs once more than f of n minus 1. So I'm just going to assume that f of n minus 1 equals n minus 1. Pulling that out of thin air. You might think when I'm trying to prove that f of n equals n, it's weird to assume that f of n minus 1 equals n minus 1. And it does feel like I'm assuming the bulk of my function. But note here, I am assuming that all of the previous steps worked and showing this step works. We'll see how this all bootstraps together here in a moment. Then, using this argument, f of n runs the loop once more, f of n minus 1, returning f of n minus 1 plus 1, which equals n. I should probably say this also equal. And then, because it holds in both cases, it holds in general, we're going to have a different way of wording that when we're doing this assume. Okay, now, this thing I have created here is a function for creating proofs. If you pick an n, say I want to prove it holds for 7. To prove it holds for 7, I look at this. 7 is not equal to 1, so I'm in this case. And this case asks me to assume this thing, which is another run for the case of 6. 6 is not this case, so I'm down here, so I've got another run for 5, and another run for 4, and another run for 3, and another run for 2, and another run for 1, until eventually I get down to the case 1, which just solves. And then I can sort of finish up the other pieces. Okay? So it acts like recursion or like a loop in code. I am giving you this guideline. Pick any n you want and these steps. You're going to use this step however many times you need to get down to that step to end up with an n step proof question. Yes, we can. We'll show the general principle here that will work in all cases in just a moment. And I'll have both of those forms. Other question. Magic! No, we're actually proving an implication here under the hood. Okay? So what's really going on? If I want to prove the theorem A implies B, then a proof strategy for this is my proof is allowed to say assume A. Work, work, work. Therefore, B. Okay, this is a way of proving an implication. So I'm actually doing inside of this is I have two proofs, two pieces of my proof. This proof is proving me that f of 1 equals 1. This proof is showing me that f of n minus 1 equals n minus 1 implies that f of n equals. And that's actually all I have proven. It is a great question. So this is induction, but I've phrased it like proof by cases. And you notice I can't say that I have proven it by standard cases, because the first one proved that f of n equals n, but the second one only proved that if we were allowed to assume something. What I've actually proven is an implication. I haven't proved this end result by itself. I've only proved this end result if we're allowed to assume this other thing. And so I need something to tie together these two cases, something a little bit more than cases. Just like in a loop in code, I'm continually checking to see if I was inside this bounds, but I need to go around again. That go around again part of a proof by induction is called the principle of induction. Okay? So there's a name for this thing. It is called the principle of induction. The principle of induction is, if I know something holds at zero, and I know that it holding at k implies it holds at k plus one, which incidentally is fully equivalent to it holds at k minus one implies it holds at k, then I can derive it holds for all of the natural. And the reason the principle of induction works is it provides me with a proof template, a guide to creating larger proofs. If you give me zero, I just do this. Let's suppose you gave me two. How would I use this to prove two? Well, I know P of zero. I also know that P of zero implies P of one, which means, therefore, I know P of one. And I know P of one implies P of two. And I combine the fact I know P of one and the fact of P of one implies P of two to mean I show I know P of two. And so a proof of P of two would use two instantiations of this generic implication and show my whole thing. To make this formal, this is a generic implication. I have to actually show this for all K in the natural. The way I usually do that is by ignoring the value of K. Right? If you can prove something without telling you what K is, then you've proven it in general. And then this one, therefore, would be for all K in the positive integers, because I'm doing subtraction instead. Questions about this principle of induction? Coming back to our proof, I'm not done because case one and case two need to be combined. But they can't be simply combined because they didn't prove the same things. Instead of both of them proving f of n equals n, the first one proved f of n equals n for one n, and the second one proved there's an implication. That implication gets tied to the other thing by saying, by the principle of induction. That's the magic phrase. Okay? The magic phrase I use is by the principle of induction. The principle of induction always has two cases. I guess actually you can have multiple of the first cases, but this last case is different than the earlier case. Last case is different in the earlier case, and so we want to label it differently so we know which one was which. We're going to call this the inductive step. And we're going to call this the base case. And those names are going to help us know how the principle of induction applies. And then what the principle of induction allows me to say is that for all of the integers greater than or equal to my base case, so in that case it's the positive integers, I know here I have a full proof of the correctness of this trivial program. Questions. The principle of induction is defined over the non-negative integers. If I wanted to apply it to something else, I would need to have some reduction, some way of transferring what I'm dealing with to these non-negative integers. So technically what I've done here is I've hand-waved over the fact that I'm starting at 1 instead of 0. Why am I allowed to hand-wave over the fact that I'm starting at 1 instead of 0? Effectively, my P in this case, my thing I'm asserting is true in general, is that F, let me actually do this in a different color, right? So P of N is defined to be, in this case, sorry, that's a symbol we don't use very often, let me use it. By P of N, I mean F of N plus 1 equals N plus 1 on the previous slide. Okay, what do I mean by this? The principle of induction needs to work for some predicate over the natural numbers, the non-negative integers. I wanted to prove something is proof for all the numbers one bigger than that. And so there exists this magic offset to move the numbers over. And so I can do that. I can just move the numbers over in order to show that this works. And usually I will assume that you understand I can do this and not mention it in the text of the proof. Because in practice, this works effectively on well-ordered sets, right? Subsets of the integers. It's not quite that, because I really do need to sort of hit every step along the way. But it works for things that are like this set. For some vague definition of like this set. You're welcome. Other question. All right. In interest of seeing how this works in sort of small steps, let's take a very small adjustment. Let's make our g of x. I'm still going to start x at 0. I'm still going to have our I from 1 to n. But now I'm going to say x gets I added to it instead of 1. This one's messier. Okay, let's first figure out what we think this function equals. So if I give it 0, it'll give me back 0. If I give it 1, it'll give me back 1. If I give it 2, it will give me back 1 plus 2 is 3. If I give it 3, it'll give me back 1 plus 2 plus 3 is 6. If I give it 4, it'll give me 10. If I give it 5, it'll give me 15. If I give it 6, it'll give me 21. Ugh! What is the formula that captures this idea? The formula that captures this idea is x plus 1. I should be consistent in my variable naming. If I'm going to call one of those in, I should call the other one in. And so these should all be n's here. Sorry. I used x for two different... Oh, did you have any reason to know this? So some of you have probably bumped into it before. There are various ways of deriving it. This is not a class about analyzing sequences of integers, so we're just going to tell you this is what it equals. Okay? And so here is our theorem. We want to make our theorem for all n in the non-negative integers. We want to show... Wait, hold on, let me verify that I got this right. 2 times 3, yes, okay, good. We want to verify that g of n equals n plus 1. And we're going to do this by induction. This was actually a formula that we showed by the well-ordering principle last week from our textbook. We're now going to do it by induction. The induction's going to look very much like the last induction. All induction has a very similar form, but this one particularly, because we haven't changed very much about what we're doing. Okay, we're always going to have a base case and an inductive step. The base case will be the smallest thing the theorem is supposed to be defined over. It has to be the smallest thing, because we're going to use that to bootstrap all of the other proofs. So if we wanted to start the second or the third thing, we'd also have to prove the ones that came before it independently. Because our inductive step is just going to get us from one number to the next bigger number. And so we have to have some way of getting that bottom step. So our base case here is going to be that g of 0 equals 0. Because it doesn't loop. Easy. And my inductive step, remember, the goal of my inductive step is to show that g of, we'll do it the other way here. No, let's do it the same way for similarity. We're going to say we want to prove that g of n minus 1 implies, g of n minus 1 equaling n minus 1, that's the theorem at n minus 1, needs to imply g of n equals n. That's the wrong formula. I want to show it equals n minus 1 n over 2, and this needs to imply it equals n plus 1 over 2, because that's the equation that I'm trying to prove. And the way I prove an implication is by doing an assumption. So I'm going to assume that g of n minus 1 equals n minus 1 times n over 2. And then I'm going to try to prove the thing that it is implying to show this implication. Then, g of n runs the loop once more, than g of n minus 1. So what does that mean? If I run the loop once more, I add an extra n to the end. So that means I'm going to return g of n minus 1 plus n, right? Whatever the previous thing would have done with one extra n added onto it. And now I just need to do some algebra. So that means g of n equals n minus 1 n over 2 plus n. Magic of algebra. N minus, well, let's actually multiply this through. That's going to be n squared minus n over 2 plus 2n over 2, which is going to be equal to, adding those things up, n squared plus n over 2, which is equal to, which is what I was trying to prove. So there's my inductive step. And it's important at the end to say, by the principle of induction for all n element of the non-negative integers. And this is our second proof by induction. Any questions? We've got 3 more days of class where we're going to talk about induction and try to teach you other cases of how it works and so forth. So when we come back on Wednesday, we'll look into some additional inductive steps. Then on Monday and Wednesday of next week, we'll talk in particular about summation notations and product notations and special tricks we use to make these proofs work. So I will look forward to seeing you all on Wednesday.